Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You graduate with this economics degree. You go from strip club DJ to Uber driver to stand-up comedy. What gave you the kind of ability to say, nope, I'm not going to do what my parents want me to do?
I think it's fear and desperation.
What were you afraid of?
I mean, just picturing myself sitting behind a desk until I was 65.
A lot of people say, okay, I'll do this for a few years while I pursue another dream.
Right.
You didn't do that.
I couldn't. After 2 months at this internship, I literally want to kill myself. I can't do it. Physically, it was impossible.
What veered you into comedy?
Look, it takes a lot of desperation, especially for me who never really grew up with stand-up. I wasn't like, oh, I saw Eddie Murphy on stage, I need to do stand-up at some point. It wasn't that. It was just like, well, fuck, what am I doing with my life? Nothing. So Googling local open mics is the last step before you Google what's the best way to kill myself. So I did that. I Googled local open mics. I wasn't that funny, but I think I found a community pretty immediately of comedians who are bumbling around just like me. There was a sense of purpose there. You know, if you get good at this, there might be a future at something.
So I've got Jimmy Yang in the house today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So two credits I want to mention, but there's many, of course. One is you're one of the main stars of my favorite, or one of my favorite TV shows, top five TV show for me, Silicon Valley on HBO. It's a great show. You're going into, what is it, the fourth season?
I forget. Fifth season. We just finished shooting the fifth one, yeah.
And then also just out, and I just read it, How to American by Jimmy Yang.
Thank you so much.
And just to mention, on Silicon Valley, you play Gene Yang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and people would be probably not surprised, but your voice is obviously, you're the only person whose voice is probably very different from the show as it is in real life.
A lot of people come up to me, like say they're a fan of the show, and they're surprised. And they're like, oh my God, you actually speak English. And they get surprised, which at first I thought it was kind of an insult. And I'm like, well, maybe I should take it as a compliment for acting, you know. But it's interesting because nobody's ever, say, went up to Johnny Depp and it was like, I didn't know you weren't actually a pirate, you know? So
So why do you think that is? Because obviously
the Asian
he's not a
thing,
pirate.
Or maybe because I'm Asian, maybe I'm a better actor than Johnny Depp. Who knows? I don't know. The jury's out.
And also, you're the only one on the show,
yeah,
whose voice is different in
real life. Who plays more of a character than just myself.
Yeah. I mean, when you first came on the show, I mean, even from this book, mm-hmm. it was unclear how much there. At first, you really were, quote unquote, just a character. You were like this.
I had two lines.
Yeah. You were this odd person that T.J. Miller, who played Ehrlich Bachman, was incubating in his incubator along with the main cast.
Yeah.
And then you were just so hilarious, you became part of the main cast.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. And, you know, that was my big break. Before that, I was like driving Uber, you know. So I kind of snuck in on the show. Like, it started off two lines and then it gave me another two lines with the I Eat the Fish scene. And I think we saw there's some really fun dynamic with me and TJ. And then in the off season between season one and two, we didn't know if, first of all, Silicon Valley is going to come back. And second of all, if my character is going to come back, because I was just a guest star. I got paid $900 a day, you know. And then I got an offer to do a Yahoo series because Yahoo was going into original programming. It's one of their first ever shows. And I got like a series regular part. But the thing was, each HBO and Yahoo needed exclusivity. So I can either do one or the other. So I'm like, oh my God, I would love to be a series regular for the first time in my life on Yahoo, but I can't just not do this HBO show if it comes back. So it was like one of the most nerve-wracking like morning in my life. I was waiting for my agent's call and then I was drinking at the farmer's market at the Grove in LA at like 11 a.m., you know?
Drinking what?
Drinking beer. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like alcoholic beverages at 11 a.m.
Farmer's market. Yeah, I didn't even know they had
with a bunch of local drunks, you know. Yeah, at a farmer's market. There's one bar in there. And yeah, and then finally I got the call from my agent. She was like, yeah, we're going to see if HBO can match the offer to make you a series regular. And I'm like, you're crazy. They're never going to do that. And then they did. And here I am.
So, you know, because obviously I don't even know what happened to that Yahoo. I don't even know what happened to Yahoo Originals in general. I think that just was an idea, a flash in the pan, yeah. And disappeared.
They had two shows called Other Space. That was a Paul Feig show. I heard it's very funny, but just nobody watched it because nobody who has a Yahoo app, right? And then the other show that I was going to do was called Sin City Saints, about like an expansion basketball team.
I loved that idea, by the way. You mentioned it in the book. I thought that was a brilliant idea, the idea of having like this basketball team in Las Vegas and the stories behind it, I assume. You almost think like an idea like that could succeed on a Netflix or an Amazon or something like that.
Yeah, but everything is just such a crapshoot now. Like I'm so lucky the first show that I'm a series regular on became like a hit because so many, like you hear stories where George Clooney got like 17 pilots that never aired or something like that. And then so many comics that's been around forever that's super funny and they get on shows, good shows, and they never make it past the first season.
Well, this kind of, you know, I want to get into the Silicon Valley stuff, your career, the book and everything. But I'm curious what your thoughts are on TV in general because like you said, there's so many new shows out there. It's not like there's three channels anymore and then HBO. Mm-hmm. Netflix is going to spend $11 billion on original content.
Crazy.
Amazon's going to spend $10 billion. And while that seems like a great thing for actors, writers, directors, producers, it could be a bad thing too in that kind of the day of five-season shows is going to be over because they're just going to keep pouring money. They're going to just eliminate last year's everything except the top, and just make new shows. And there's no more syndication. Netflix is not syndicating to TBS. So media has turned upside down. Like we had one really well-known guy on who had a show on Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu.
Wow.
And I can guarantee you, if I named all three, you would not have heard of two of them.
Right.
Even though everybody on all three shows is a big name.
Yeah, it's good and bad, right? Because I think back in the day when you have like four network channels, when you're on a show, you've made it like big time because everybody's watching you. Now the eyeballs are like more spread out, but at least these people have a job. At least people that's working on a Hulu show that you never heard of is getting paid a salary. You know what I mean? So it's good and bad.
I guess that's true. So like let's say there's 5,000 working comedians, then another 100,000 working actors.
Yeah.
You know, at least now they have a chance for a year, 2 years to make a salary, have a chance to stand out and break out.
Yes.
Whereas before they might not have.
Yeah. Whereas before we were struggling driving Uber.
Well, let's talk about that for a second because you use the word struggle. It's like your most interesting IMDb credit is you're in a film about driving Uber.
Oh yeah. Well, that was a short film me and my buddy did. There's actually this upcoming film. I didn't end up getting the part, but it's called Stuber. that they're developing a Sony. It's about an Uber driver that gets into some trouble. So I think that's becoming more and more mainstream. And I'm not ashamed of driving Uber. It was fun when it lasted.
Well, I showed you a video. I guess you make your own hours. Did you make money? How much money did you make a week at an Uber?
That was when you can make a little more money. Now Uber's so cheap now, so it's hard, right? Because back in the day, I think I made like maybe...
This podcast sponsored by Uber.
$25 an hour or something back in the day, which wasn't bad. And I drove a Prius. I did that actually between season one and two of Silicon Valley. I used whatever $3,000 to pay me from season one to like put in as a down payment a used Prius. And that's how I survived for a little longer.
So how much did you make per day as an Uber driver?
How much can I make per day?
Yeah.
I don't know, like $200, $300. And if it's Halloween or New Year's Eve, you can make like, you know, $600.
And what was the craziest Uber experience you had?
You know, people ask me that and...
Oh, so I'm not original? Are you saying I'm not original?
No, you're fine. You're fine. It just, I'm saying this is a me problem. I don't really have a great answer for that. It's nothing nuts. There's like drunk people and like really self-entitled club goers. Those are horrible people. You know, so I lost a little faith in humanity afterwards.
Okay,
but
why?
Nuts.
What was like an example from a club goer? Considering you were a strip club DJ, what did you see it from the kind of night, you know, the club hopping, drunk Uber experience that really made you lose faith in humanity after being a strip club DJ?
Like being a strip, I've seen a lot, right? Being a strip club DJ, it was at a really seedy strip club too in San Diego. And I've seen a lot of interacted with those girls. I interacted with, you know, the gangsters that own the place, that ran the place. But they're, at the end of the day, they're kind of genuine people. You know, they just end up in this situation. And I always empathize with that. But these club goers, sometimes they don't even treat the Uber driver like a human being. And that's the issue with it.
Like what was an example?
Like people just leaving drinks and like open bottles everywhere. They make you wait like 15 minutes. And I think Uber has done some things to, you know, make it better. I used to actually wish people would throw up in my car because I had a shitty old car. Old Prius, like a 2006 Prius. So if they threw up in my car, Uber would pay me like a $300 cleaning fee. So I was wishing people would throw up in my car, but that never happened.
So, okay. So you're in between season one and season two of Silicon Valley. You were making $900 a day doing like a couple lines
the
here and there.
Actor minimum, yep.
And you get this opportunity at Yahoo, which it would be unclear whether is this going to be a Netflix or is this going to be nothing.
Yeah.
But HBO has such cachet.
Yeah.
And by the way, Silicon Valley, even after season one, I think there was this great sense.
There was already some buzz, yep.
Yeah, and
it's Mike Judge.
It's Mike Judge, Alec Berg, who was, you know, not only Curb Your Enthusiasm, but Seinfeld. You know, so there's this rich history in Silicon Valley. And also you get this sense with HBO that they've mastered the kind of entourage concept. Like, let's take a real world environment and throw some superstars in it and see what happens. So they did it with Entourage in Hollywood. I feel Silicon Valley was their version of doing that in a funny Mike Judge sort of way in Silicon Valley.
And really, they have an all-star comedy team. I mean, those main five guys. And then you had first season, you had Christopher Evan Welch, you know, of course, Amanda Crew, and everyone. Matt Ross, amazing actors, you know. I think Alec sent a recent interview. It's like, we got a deep bench, you know. And then when I came in, I came off the bench, you know, I was able to hit some threes. So like, it just kind of worked out, you know.
No, but I mean, right from the beginning, you were funny. And so I would say it's different than from the beginning. We see TJ Miller is playing almost this comedic role. You're playing more of a character that's extremely funny. But you evolved, obviously, into having depth and you know, being consistently, you know, having a motivation that was consistently funny like the other actors. So you grew into the role. But I mean, did you get the sense that this was somehow special? That's why you wanted to keep on doing Silicon Valley?
I mean, first of all, Mike Judge was my commencement speaker in my college.
At UCSD?
Yeah, at UCSD. He was talking about he was a physics major and then he didn't like that. So he ended up eventually finding his passion in animation, which spoke to me at the time because I was an economics major and I wanted nothing to do with that. I didn't want to go into finance.
Who ever does? Like who in your class became an economist?
It's or finance. Like nobody goes into it because they love it. Right. Like you love money maybe, right? So I didn't want to do that and I was kind of lost and then eventually I found stand-up. So that speech like kind of really spoke to me.
But let me ask you about that. Yeah. So Mike Judge, you know, first off, he did Office Space. Uh-huh. But really, like, what inspired me most with Mike Judge was back in the day, Beavis and Butthead was just brilliant.
Yep.
And it's not even sophisticated comedy. It's not like he's making...
I think deep down, it is. You can see the sophistication, but on the surface, it's like two bumbling idiots, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the humor is brilliant.
Yeah.
The actual drawings and the his budget for animation was probably not very high at
well,
that time.
Well, that's just, yeah, his right hand, yeah. Basically.
And it's funny. But it was brilliant in terms of, like, everybody in the country started talking like Beavis and Butthead at once that show started airing. So he had this, like, really great comedic sense. Do you think, what veered you into comedy? You know, was it in part Mike Judge kind of showing, hey, anything's possible? Or even in the book, suddenly you're going up for stand-up comedy.
Right.
It was a little unclear what the bridge was.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I think it's growing up, I was the youngest in the family. Well, I've an older brother. And whenever there was like any type of argument or disagreement, I have to be the funny one to kind of diffuse the situation. Mm. And also coming here from Hong Kong when I was 13, not even like knowing the language very well, I can't fight, you know, I'm little. So like I have to use humor to kind of deflect and defend myself. And when people like start talking shit, I have to come up with some comebacks. So I think that's when I developed a sense of humor. Instead of, you know, fighting, you know, I was able to joke my way around a lot of situations. So I think stand-up comedy, because I tried a bunch of different things when I told you I didn't want to do finance or economics. I tried jiu-jitsu, I tried boxing, I tried whatever. Honestly, I was horrible at those two things, obviously.
Wait, what?
And then stand-up spoke to me.
Did you try, I mean, I read about you trying jiu-jitsu and it was funny in the book.
Yeah.
The book, by the way, I'm going to recommend it over and over. But
thank you.
Your stories in the book are hilarious. It's a great book. I'll comment more about it later. But I didn't get the sense you're trying jiu-jitsu as a career in the book.
I was so lost. I just wanted to find a community of anything. It might not have been maybe not being a UFC fighter, but maybe a jiu-jitsu instructor or finding somebody there, a community there that would hook me up with a job at somewhere else. You know, I was just lost. I needed to find like new people that I can hang out with, or else my life seemed like a dead end to me. Even right after I graduated college, it was very scary. I was like 22, but my life, I was like, either I'm gonna go into finance and sit behind a desk forever, or I'm just gonna meander around forever. Like I had no idea what the hell I wanted to do.
And what were your like best college friends doing?
One of them was an engineering major, and then someone went to grad school, someone was pre-med, went to medical school. A lot of them continued just working. And then one of my best friends from high school, he just started working construction for his family. So it's either family business that they fell into because they needed a job, or they continue the education, but not any of them, I don't think, ended up, you know, pursuing their passion, especially not right after college.
But what's interesting though is, and this is a conflict that goes throughout the book and throughout your story, is it sounds like all your best friends were pursuing things their parents would still love.
Right.
Would still love them for their job. And you mentioned how it's like, you know, family, money, and forget passions.
Right, that's
it's
the
like
very
the rules
Chinese
of
foreign culture.
Yeah.
It's you make money, be safe. Because my dad came from a place like he had lived through the communist revolution when he was young. So he didn't even get the chance to go to a university, even though he wanted to, and he was very smart. So he wanted nothing but the best for me. He wanted me to go to university and like find a safe job because I have the opportunity now that they have given me. And I still don't want to do that. So you can see how disappointed he would be. And I understand that. But, you know, in the book I wrote, like, I felt like I had to disappoint my parents for a few years instead of disappointing myself for the rest of my
life.
That's
a hard thing because, again, all your friends are not disappointing their parents. Probably maybe a lot of other Asian Americans that you knew that were your age were not disappointing their parents. What gave you kind of the few neurons that went on instead of off? What gave you the kind of ability to say, nope, I'm not going to do what my parents want me to do?
I don't think it's like confidence or that. I think it's fear and desperation.
What were you afraid of?
I mean, just picturing myself sitting behind a desk until I was 65.
That's really mature
job.
To project that far out into the future at that age. Like a lot of people say, okay, I'll do this for a few years while I pursue another dream.
Right.
You know, you didn't do that.
I couldn't. After like 2 months at this internship, like I literally want to kill myself. Like I can't do it, you know? Like physically, it was impossible.
That was the Smith Barney?
Yeah, Smith Barney. It was a very prestigious financial firm. It's an internship that my dad hooked me up with. And I just, they even offered me a job and I just couldn't do it. So I think part of it, it's got to be a genetic makeup where maybe I'm more risk-taking and literally I wouldn't allow myself to do something like that. I just couldn't do it.
Was it a rebellion?
I don't know if it's a rebellion. Maybe it's a quiet rebellion. I didn't do it on purpose. Maybe subconscious. But a lot of it, I think it's a desperation of like, I wasn't really getting laid either. So like, I needed to go get laid somehow. Like sitting behind a desk ain't gonna help me.
So right, so let's analyze this because it's very interesting. So sitting behind a desk, you're thinking to yourself, okay, there's 6,000 or a million other people in the surrounding 20 miles that are sitting behind desks.
Yes.
And all of them either make more money than me.
Yep.
Or in your mind, you think they have some other status over me that I'm not going to achieve for several years at least until I'm like made partner or make more money or whatever.
Yeah.
And you figured, okay, I had built up this force field of comedy to defend myself growing up in school.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you were insulting the bullies back or having the bullies lay off of you because you were funny. So they thought you were cool or whatever. So you figured you had this skill. You didn't know what it was, but you figured at the very least, it could potentially be a status enough skill that if you worked harder at it, you would meet a girl.
Maybe.
I'm being a psychoanalyst. $600 an hour.
That's not a bad analysis. I mean, it's pretty on point. And I think a lot of stand-ups feel that way. And a lot of us, we do what we do is because we are not content with what we already have. I mean, if you look at people, I got friends that, you know, say grew up in Ohio and they got married when they're 18 and they have three kids by the time they're 20. Very content. I wish I could be more like that. Right? But I can't. I don't know why, but it just, I'm not, I wanted to live life and I get antsy and I panic when I'm not constantly doing stuff.
So do you think that's because, and this is not judgmental on, I mean, I also often wish, boy, why couldn't I be one of those, you know, right now, just to mention to the listeners, this is the first time I'm doing a podcast. We're on the stage at Stand Up New York, which is a club that it's a comedy club I partially own. And often, and I'm just mentioning to you, often in the audience here, when I'm on stage, I'll ask them, how long have you been together? A couple.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's these couples that have been together 25 years, and I'll say, well, have you ever had any major difficulties? And they'll look at each other like, no, not really. And so I wonder about this, and I wonder if just some people are not, and this is not judgmental, but some people are just not so complex, and they're just happy being regular. And
I wish I'm more like that. And I don't know if it's not complex. And if you want to really go like Dr. Drew on this, you know, which I listened to like growing up on Loveline.
Dr. Drew
wrote a blurb.
Wrote a blurb on the back of your book.
He's a friend. He's awesome. So I always, you know, think about stuff in that kind of Loveline analysis sense. Maybe I grew up around a little more chaos because of the immigration, because my family maybe. That's why I'm used to a more unstable, you know, risk-taking life. Maybe it's genetics. Or maybe those people that you say are possibly less complex and more comfortable, they grew up in a, you know, they're used to a more calming environment back home. So they can just go out and be happy and find a family when they're 18 and settle down.
Yeah, so it could be like the immigration was obviously a big upheaval in
jolt,
your life.
Turning stuff upside down. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And trauma, usually people narrowly define, but if you broadly define it as like a jolt like that, it was a traumatic event. Moving from one country to another country where you didn't really speak the language.
Right.
That's traumatic. At the age of 13, which is the age for the rest of your life you're going to identify your id with, is going to be you're always that 13-year-old boy who's
you kind of stuck in that age. Yeah. And I never thought it was traumatic. I still don't think it's traumatic. I think it's what made me who I am, whatever that might be, you know.
Sure, but traumatic doesn't have to be bad.
Yeah, right. I'm just saying, like, I never looked at it as like, I'm a victim. Why did this have to happen to me? I don't think that's positive at all. And, you know,
Then there was the bullies. Then there's the fact that these jobs seemed horribly boring to you.
Yeah.
So at some point, you said, "Okay, I'm funny. I want to meet a girl. I need some." It's all part of this calculation of how can I get higher status in my life, given the variables that already exist.
I think that maybe that's always in the back of my mind. I want this. How do I get that? Right. I think that's everybody has that mechanism, but it wasn't a very conscious decision. I was seriously just like bumbling around trying to find something that will make me feel a little better about myself and to find a new group of friends. Right. You know, but yeah, it was more in the back of my mind. It wasn't like, okay, I'm gonna get girls, so I'm gonna go do stand up and do this. That was part of it, but it was never because of that necessarily. You know.
And so what happened? Like, how did you? What was the first stand up experience like?
I signed up for an open mic. Well, I Googled local open mics, and I think that was like ChuckleMonkey.com. That I think is still around. And one of the most consistent open mic I could find at an actual comedy club was the Haha Comedy Club in North Hollywood. You got to pay $5 for 5 minutes of open mics in front of five pissed off comics that's waiting for their own turn. So yeah, I Googled it, and then I was, look, it takes a lot of desperation, especially for me who never really grew up with stand-up. I wasn't like, oh, I saw Eddie Murphy on stage, I need to do stand-up at some point. It wasn't that. It was just like, well, fuck, what am I doing with my life? Nothing. So it's, I was like in the book, I think I said like Googling local open mics is the last step before you Google what's the best way to kill myself.
Right.
So I did that. I Googled local open mics and I went to Haha Comedy Club and it was fun. I wasn't that funny, but I think I found a community like pretty immediately of just these comedians who are bumbling around just like me, these open micers. But there was a sense of purpose there. You know, if you get good at this, there might be a future at something.
So did you start, how regularly were you doing these open
mics? I started
mics?
Doing it every day.
Every single day?
7 days a week. They have an open mic right before the regular show. So I had nothing better to do. I was just playing video games at my dad's house. So I just went up every day. That was during the summer, junior year, I think, when I was in college. So I still had to go back to San Diego. And when I went back to San Diego, that's when I really kind of polished my act. I got a job at the Comedy Palace down there and really got some real stage time.
What does it mean, polish your act?
Just, I guess, doing open mics, polishing my act too. But, you know, building my act. Building from a 5 minute open mic set where you have maybe one good bit to a solid 5 minutes to 10 minutes to 15 minutes, right? And then I think I spent maybe a year and a half in San Diego doing that. And then I got pretty regular stage time on real shows on the weekends, even on showcases, which is, I guess, pretty rare, especially for an LA comedian to get in, you know, a year. But luckily I was in San Diego, so there's less competition, more stage time in a way. Or less competition for the stage time. And eventually, I got fairly good. I think I got like a really solid 20 minutes that people are like really starting to respond to. Looking back, some of the stuff was hack. You know, I was like a year, 2 years in. Of course it was hack, but I was comfortable on stage. You know, I developed enough where I was getting laughs. And that's when I moved back to LA. Well, because of other circumstances too, because the strip club DJ job I had also got a little too dangerous. So I had to move to LA. That forced me to go to LA.
In one interview, you basically say, and it's kind of the funniest thing, you basically say at some point you had a fork in the road about whether to continue as a strip club DJ or, you know, move to LA. I don't think many people have that kind of fork in the road in their lives. Like,
yeah, you know, it was
maybe describe a little just what was the strip club DJing like?
So I think when you're 22, working a strip club is like a lot of kids' dreams, you know what I mean? Like, it's awesome, right? Like, you think you're gonna go, like, have sex with, like, cool strippers, hang out with, like, cool gangster people. At least I thought that was cool. But really, you soon realized it was a really seedy strip club also. It's not like a nice, like, whatever, Spearman Rhino or anything. It's a really seedy club ran by, like, this gangster. But he was always really nice to me. He's always, you know, taken a liking to me. And you soon realized none of these people that worked there wanted to work there. I was the only idiot that wanted to work there. Those people have been in prison and that they have no choice but to work there, right?
Who's they? Like, who are the…
Okay, so the bouncer's name… I changed the name in the book, but in the book, his name is Beast because he looked like a beast. Like, honestly, like… and his real name's not too far from that. And these are all nicknames they earn in prison. And he was in the Aryan Brotherhood in prison. I'm sure he didn't like me working there, you know. And then there's a bar shift manager named Chef. The owner's name was Shooter. And they're just actual people that went to prison, not just jail, but like prison, like gangsters. And all the strippers, like I was really nice with the strippers. I'm not an asshole like to anyone really. So I was trying to bring professionalism into a strip club, which was great for like the business, right? But then I started getting like friend zoned by the strippers. Like I was too nice. I couldn't even get laid with the strippers. They would literally sit in the DJ booth naked next to me, telling me about problems with their boyfriends. And I'm like, this is the most miserable thing ever. I'm like trying to cross my legs, hiding my boner with this like beautiful naked woman next to me, and I have to listen to her boyfriend. Like, are you kidding me? And then eventually it got like kind of crazy because Shooter really liked me. And he was like, oh, hey, kid, you know, strip club. Lap dance sales went up 44% the first week you were here. I didn't know he was keeping numbers like that. But I guess the thing was, I was pretty good on the microphone already because I had training as a stand-up. And I was pretty good as a salesman because I was selling used cars also back in San Diego. So I combined the two skills and I became like a pretty good like lap dance salesman, right? And yeah, he really liked me and he offered. He was like, I just came into some money and I want to open up a strip club for you to run. So think about it. Let me know. Which, it's not an easy decision, especially for someone who like me who thinks that kind of stuff is cool.
And also like 22 or 23, you're showing aptitude and potentially you can make, who knows, $300,000-$500,000 a year running one of these clubs.
Yeah, exactly. And sitting next to naked women, you know, which, yeah.
Combine those skills. Like,
oh, yeah.
Use car salesman.
Well, because I think combining the skills, when you're a strip club DJ, your job is, first of all, to keep the girls on time, make sure to get on stage. So I was nice to him, so they had no problem doing that. And your main job is to sell lap dances. You want everybody like that's sitting in the regular area go into the VIP. So I'll basically high pressure sales them, but I know how to talk on the microphone because I'm a stand up. So I was able to combine the two. Like,
so you were able to combine kind of the sales techniques of used car salesmen with, let's say, kind of the audience control you learn.
Exactly,
with
I can read the crowd. Like,
right.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, 2-for-1 lap dance going on right now. Get two girls for the price of one in the same room, or get two lap dances for the price of one. Don't be shy with your wallet. Don't be tight. And then I would literally do crowd work and point people out. You gentlemen over there with a nice polo shirt, I see Jade is looking over you. You know, you should get two lap dances with her for the price of one right now. And then I would seriously just like high pressure sales them, and it will kind of work.
That's so funny. So okay, fork in the road.
How did I sell a car? I brought strippers to the car lot. No, I didn't.
So okay, fork in the road. How did you decide?
It actually, something kind of happened where I had to spend Christmas at the strip club. I worked on Christmas Day on the strip club. That was just so miserable in itself. And then we closed early because fortunately there weren't a lot of customers in there that night. And then these two drunk college kids came in. They were like, oh, hey, man, and on your Yelp page, it says you guys close at 2. Like, what's up? It's 12 o'clock. We want to see some titties, you know? And I'm like, no, we're closed. And then Beast, the bouncer, was like, yeah, just leave. We're closed. He was like, man, that's not cool. That's not fair. So then they left, but they were still like talking shit outside of the club, like cussing us out. And then Beast wouldn't have it. And then he went up to Chef, the bar manager. He's like, all right, let's go. And then they went outside. Chef grabbed like a 2x4 table leg that he had ready as a weapon. And then I follow him outside. The next thing I know, like, you know, Beast got the dude in a chokehold and like Chef was like beating them in the ribs. And that picture in itself was like just like an alert for me, you know, because I was the age. I should be in those college students' shoes because I was their age. You know, I want to party. I want to hang out. I was them. But I have crossed over to the other side. I'm now an employee of this gangster side, and I could have totally went to jail that night, you know? And then the next day, I remember I was at the comedy club, like bragging to my buddies. I'm like, dude, like yesterday, man, it was fucking cool, dude. We beat up these two kids, blah, blah, blah. And then my buddy, who's always been a mentor of mine, Sean Kelly, he's a comedian in San Diego, who eventually made it as a reality show star in England. Great, great guy, really smart guy. And he called me, he was like, dude, I heard you telling those stories at the comedy club. It's not cool. You're a funny dude. You need to get the fuck out of there as soon as possible and move to LA and try to make it as a stand-up. And I did. You know, I quit like the next day and I moved to LA, I think the next week.
So you arrive in LA. I guess you start doing stand up there, but you're also starting to go on auditions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously you must have had a lot of rejection, but the first question I have is, what did you see as the difference between your experiences doing stand up in LA versus San Diego? Because now there's much more competition for stage time.
Yeah, LA, it's like turning on your Netflix when you do stand up in LA. It's unfocused. There's so many venues, people got so much to do, and you have to compete with stage time with Chris Rock popping in. Like, how do you do that? So I was struggling to get stage time just like everybody else. But at least I grinded out my material. So at least if I did get the stage time, I was able to be funny. Where San Diego, it's a smaller community. Not everybody's trying to get on TV. I mean, maybe they are in the back of their minds, but you know, we're just having fun and it's cool. It's like more like a fraternity. Whereas here, it's more like, I mean, not here in New York, but in LA, it's more like a business. And so I was struggling and I needed to just make ends meet at first because I rented out this dude's apartment for like $300, his living room. And I needed to come up with the rent. I needed to eat. You know, I didn't want to go back to living with my dad and be a complete failure. So I wanted, a couple of my buddies at the Comedy Store told me, like, dude, go get on some commercials. They're easy acting. Maybe just a reaction. You don't have any lines. And one dude like did a vodka commercial. I got paid like $60,000 in residuals. And the other dude, like, you know, that's like a lottery ticket that I was like, oh shit, so this is great. All I need is one commercial a year and I can do it. It sounds doable. But it's like, how do you find an agent in the first place? Like, nobody knows who you are. So I went on like all the casting sites, you know, LA Casting, whatever, Casting Frontier, Actors Access, signed up, paid all the money because it's a fucking racket. You got to pay $35 to upload a headshot, you know, and then like $22 per minute to upload like a reel or video. I didn't have any reel. I have like a shitty headshot that my friend took for me. And I don't have any acting reel, so I just put my stand-up in as my reel. And on the bottom in the comment box, I just wrote, new in town, good comedic timing, looking for representation. And luckily, I got like two calls maybe from like really, really small agencies in a couple of months. The first one, the agency was in an apartment rental office. And he had me read like a Staples commercial, like a size, like Staples, where like blah, blah, blah. And I was so bad, I was rejected by that agency that was in an apartment rental office.
I remember reading about that, but describe, how were you bad at reading a Staples commercial?
I didn't even know what an audition was. Like, they're like, slate your name. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Right? Really, that just means say your name. I'm like, why didn't you just tell me that? Just tell me, say my name. Why do you have to say slate? What is that? So it's like, I just looked like a rookie that was very nervous. It's nerves, you know? I don't think you can really fuck up a Staples commercial, but it's just nerves and you're not even acting like a human being at that point. And then eventually I found my agent, Jane, who was in a small agency, and she took me to kind of, she sent me out to all these auditions. I think one of my favorite part of the book is this audition log I kept. It is 101 auditions, all of the 101 auditions that led up to my 102nd audition, which was Silicon Valley.
And you know, I talked to a lot of different actors and actresses, and rejection is basically a part of it. And the ones who survive have been rejected, you know, 101 times mm-hmm. or more. And how do you, what's the mentality you have to get to sort of survive all this rejection? Is it partly community?
I think, like acting classes, sharing the other people's struggles. Like,
were you taking acting classes?
I was. I was spending like $600 in acting classes every month when my rent was only $300, you know? And like every penny I made, like I put it into acting classes.
Were they useful? What were you learning?
Absolutely. There? I mean, just, I took a class that was literally just like audition skills. They don't teach that in acting school, but that was very important. You know, it's a different sport than stand up. Audition's a different sport than acting in a way. And eventually, you know, I got better and you know, I found my own voice. It's like finding your own voice in stand up. You got to find your own voice, who you are in acting, you know, and be truthful. I think that's the main thing that I learned. And that just takes time. It takes acting classes. It takes time of you finding yourself also. And once that clicked, it became better and I became more confident. But the rejection part, that never goes away. I still go to a lot of auditions that I get rejected for and you still get pissed, but it's like, But that's just the nature of the business. And I still have it better, I think, than 99% of the people out there, you know?
Well, and particularly now, you know, post Silicon Valley, I'm sure a lot of people are now, the calls are incoming. People want to say, we want someone like, you know, Jimmy Yang to play this role.
It's great. I mean, yeah, hopefully Silicon Valley would go. I don't know how many more seasons, but we're just done with the fifth one. And especially since my role has expanded, it's a great show because the industry watches it. People like you, people like casting directors, movie studio producers, whatever, they watch that show. So they start to know who I am. But a part of it gets lost in translations because they think I am that guy. Some people, even the industry people. So I have to prove to them like I'm actually more than just that character. You know, I'm a different person.
What kind of role would you like to play? Outside of, obviously, you like to play the Silicon Valley role, but outside of that, what would you like to play?
Well, I think Patriot's Day was a very rewarding role. I played a based on real life, also Chinese immigrant, but it was based on real life guy in a drama. It was very serious, recounting the Boston Marathon bombing. And like, it was Mark Wahlberg, J.K. Simmons, like the gods of like acting, you know? And it was really, really rewarding. It was tough. So I want to do more of that. Not necessarily just Chinese immigrant roles, although I do love those roles, especially when they have a lot of meat and a lot of dimension to them. But just something maybe like a drama, like something that's more based on real life and more meaningful than just being funny. I mean, I love being funny. It's great. But
well, you know, I mean, Silicon Valley is an interesting show because obviously there's a couple things interesting, I think. Obviously, it's a sitcom, but almost all the actors are either hardcore stand-up comedians like TJ Miller was up until this, you know, he's not in the next season, but up until this, his background is also stand-up comedian. You have Martin Starr, who's been doing comedic acting since Freaks and Geeks, who's just brilliant. Kumail, obviously, is stand-up. There's like more, and HBO seems good at this, throw a lot of stand-up comedians in the show. This dates back all the way to the Larry Sanders show. Put a bunch of stand-up comedians in the show, let them go, and they're going to be better than regular actors. I don't know if that's true or not. Like, there's a difference between actors and, like, you could see the difference, you know, on many shows where even shows that are about comedy or sitcoms, if you don't have stand-ups in the show, they're missing some comedic element. And I think Silicon Valley, is there a lot of improv in the show?
There is a lot, and they're great improvisers, some of the best in the world, like Zach Woods and Thomas, right? And Kumail, and all those guys. But I think they're also very good actors beyond just being good stand-up. Stand-up was like their training, but they also became good actors. And I think I can say that for all of us on the show. And a lot of times, stand-ups don't know how to transition to acting. And I had trouble doing that when I was first auditioning because—
What's the hardest part?
We don't listen. We don't listen. We listen to ourselves. We might be able to listen to the audience, but we don't know how to listen. We just run our mouths and do our material. But the most important thing in acting and improv is to listen, to play with the other person. A lot of stand-ups don't know how to play with the other person. They just thinking, how am I going to make this funny? How am I going to make this funny in their own head? So once you kind of let go, trust the other person and let them in and listen to them, pay attention to them, then it's I think that's when it clicks for a lot of stand-ups or actors in general.
Did learning that ability translate into better stand-up skills as well?
I think it made me a better person in general. I think to become a better actor, I had to go to therapy because I was so like, all my emotions were so blocked being like, you know, from a Chinese culture, we don't really talk about that stuff. So I had to kind of open up more as a person, you know. I cry every now and then now, like just in real life, just when I'm watching a movie. I cry during La La Land, you know, whereas I used to never do that because, you know, we'd hold our emotions back. But that allows you to be more truthful as a performer, as an actor.
And so with Silicon Valley, again, I feel like there's this rich tradition from Seinfeld all the way up to Silicon Valley where there's all this talent. Mm-hmm. It's comedic talent, it's directing talent, it's writing talent. Yeah. And this is almost like the next generation of the Curb Your Enthusiasms and Seinfeld.
Yeah, and I hope when people look back, because like, say Seinfeld or, you know, say The Wire, when people look back to that show, he's like, yo, these guys are like stars now, like Michael B. Jordan, you know, Idris Elba and all those guys. Like, I hope people look back to Silicon Valley and be like, oh my God, this group of people, like they were all on one show. That's unbelievable, You know what I mean? It was like OKC Thunders, like OKC Thunder in the NBA. They had Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden on the same team. And now they're individually some of the best players in the league. So I hope people look back and be like, wow, that was something special.
Yeah, or for HBO shows, you look at the Larry Sanders Show. Mm-hmm. Everybody, I mean, Judd Apatow even was a writer on that show.
Right. Or Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks was amazing. Yeah. Oh, that was crazy. Unbelievable, including Martin Starr was on Silicon Valley.
Yep, exactly. James Franco, all those guys.
And on Silicon Valley, every now and then, you get a guest appearance from a real Silicon Valley person. Are those, I mean, there is some intersection between the experience of Silicon Valley and real life. I mean, it is kind of a reminiscent of real life Silicon Valley stories. Like, that is the experience of being in a startup.
Yeah, I think the writers and consultants know that our audience is very picky. They will literally look at the code on a computer and go on Reddit and say that's bullshit, right? They'll call bullshit. So we do a ton of work, the writers and the consultants. And Dick Costello's our consultant last year, I think.
Yeah, I saw him on one of the episodes.
Yeah, he was the CEO of Twitter. And
he wrote the foreword to one of my books.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
I know Dick for a long time.
That's great. And I mean, because once you have people like that, then you get a really accurate depiction of the Valley and of the people. The only maybe negative thing, but really it's a compliment that people from Silicon Valley have said to me, it's like, I can't watch this show because it reminds me too much of my life and it stresses me out.
Right, it is stressful.
So, which is a
if you're from that background,
compliment.
It's a stressful show.
Yeah.
So just the angst about how financings fall through and acquisition deals fall through and the kind of high stakes $1 million decisions you have to make, and you often make wrong decisions.
Yeah. And I mean, the writers do such a good job that it's relatable on a human level, like a failure, success, something right in front of you getting taken away. So it's not just people in Silicon Valley that will understand, you know, and I think that's what all good writing is.
Now you, in order to shoot, first off, when you finally made the decision to be a series regular, or when it, the decision
they
was,
made a decision.
They made the decision was made for you.
Yeah.
You called up Yahoo, said, no, going to go with HBO. Did they offer you like a deal? It's going to be more than
that? Yeah, it was like a 6-year deal. It wasn't like a lot of money, but I was just so happy. It was a massive raise from $900 a day, you know? And to be a series regular, I mean, I knew that day when I was sitting at that farmer's market, like my life was going to change. It was amazing.
And then I also read somewhere, I forget if it was in the book or an interview you did, that while you're shooting the series, you don't do stand-up or you don't do it as much. You basically take a break from stand-up. Do you miss it during those periods, or like, do you go right back to it when the show stops shooting?
I don't think it's the show or not. I just haven't been doing too much stand-up lately. I've recently found the juice again to do it. But one of the reasons why I wrote the book was because I kind of want to step away from stand-up a little bit.
Why is that?
Because I kept doing the same shit and I wasn't writing too much, right? I feel like stand-up, it's people like, I had like ex-girlfriends be like, you don't do anything all day. You just go on stage 10 minutes or whatever, an hour a night, and like, that's it. And I have to work hard and you don't do shit. I'm like, wait a minute. No, because I'm thinking all day. Like, people don't see that thinking process that goes through, right? Because they think you're just sitting on your couch playing video games, but I'm thinking about jokes, about bits, observing people. So I think stand-up is a very life encompassing job. If you want to really be good at it, you got to really look at the world a different way. And I wasn't doing that. I was just going on stage because somebody asked me to, or I want to keep my act sharp, or I'm doing a college to make some money. But I was doing the same old shit that I didn't want to keep doing anymore. It's not even truthful to me.
But you were thinking of new bits though.
But I didn't have the time when I'm shooting or like to think of new bits. So what I did, like, that's why I want to write the book, because there's so many stuff like the strip club DJ stuff that I never figured out how to make it into like a concise bit that can get a laugh every few seconds or like whatever, you know, that's more of like the setup punchline format. So I wrote it down long form that I've been telling my buddies, and hopefully in the future I can now grab material from the book and turn that into more of a stand-up thing or even like a one-man show thing.
Yeah, because the stories are humorous, but you mentioned also in an interview that stand-up is where you need to make a, you know, people laugh every, let's say, you say 4 seconds.
There's an expectation,
you know, every some number of seconds. And the book, you don't have to, or public speaking say you don't have to. But it does seem like you can, you know, there's certainly a lot of premises you just said, like about, you know, working in a strip club that were funny.
Yeah.
You know, the naked girl sitting next to you, but you were friend zoned.
Right.
And there's some premises there that are you know, funny.
Right. But if I would have, like I think you were chuckling when I was telling you some of that stuff, but if I would have done that, I would have said the exact same thing in front of a stand-up crowd where they had just saw, say, another stand-up or expecting me to make them laugh. They might not laugh that hard. They might just chuckle, and that's kind of not okay in stand-up, right?
What would be your approach if you were going to try to punch that up? I know
it's editing.
An on-demand challenge, but...
No, I mean, for me, it's stand-up's all trial and error in editing, right? You start off rambling a story, and then you cut it down, and you chisel away on that piece of marble until it's something. And you turn like a two-minute bit into like 30 seconds of punchlines, and that's stand-up. And a lot of people, like when they're new, they're like, oh yeah, I can do an hour. I'm like, yeah, but there's like maybe 2 minutes of good stuff in that hour. You know, you have 5 minutes of material. You don't have an hour. You can talk for an hour, but that's not stand-up. You know, so to me, I don't know. And also, I want to explore some stuff that's more like, it's funny because I think stand-ups are so cynical. Like if somebody's really bombing on stage, we'll make fun of them. Like, you know, in the back, it's like, what is he doing, a fucking TED Talk? Right? But now I actually think TED Talks are amazing. Right. And it moves people. It makes people think. So there is a time and place for that. Maybe not in a stand-up comedy club, but maybe in a one-man show format or something like that. I went to Edinburgh for the first time this past year, and I was watching 5 shows a day. And they have stand-up, one-man shows, hypnosis, plays. And that was really inspiring to know that not everything needs to be in a stand-up format where you're expecting, you know, a punchline every 5 seconds or whatever. So that was pretty liberating. And I might do a one-man show. I don't know.
Based on this book, you think?
I hope so.
And then now you're also in a few months, or I don't know if you've shot it already, but you're coming out with Crazy Rich Asians, a movie.
Yeah.
Where it's all Asian cast, basically.
First studio movie in 25 years since Joy Luck Club with a full Asian cast.
That's amazing. Why do you think there hasn't been an all Asian cast movie since then? I mean, there's like all... Everything else, even there's an, you know, My Big Greek Wedding was an all Greek cast.
I honestly don't know. And I'm used to being on set as the only Asian person in every set. And that was an amazing experience to just be an actor instead of an Asian actor in that movie. Because everybody's so talented, beautiful, and whatever. You just feel so proud to be Asian, right? And hopefully if this movie does well, that'll lead to more doors opening for movies like that.
So is that where you see the career going, is more acting and maybe more dramatic acting?
I think for now, I mean, Crazy Rich Asians, I play a very comedic role. It's a romantic comedy, but it's an interesting thing. It takes you to this different world, and I think people will find it very interesting. It's a really good film. I saw a screening for it. But yeah, I think just building characters, I really like that, because Crazy Rich Asians is based on a book of the same name. And the character I play is supposed to be the biggest asshole. He's supposed to be obese. And he's just really loud and obnoxious. And Jing Yang's an asshole, but it's a different type of asshole.
And just in person, you don't come across as an obese, annoying person. You're you're a thin,
but that's what's fun about
person.
It, right? Because
so,
I can't.
So how did you get into role? Like, what was the mental process of getting into that role?
I think there's a part of me that really wants to be that person, but I can't. Because I think there's part of us that always want to be certain. We want to pull the guy out of the car to cut us off and beat his ass. Maybe it's just me, but I think all of us has a little part of that. And I just love letting that kind of stuff out because you can't do it in real life. But really building like a three-dimensional character and be kind of naked and let that part out and be naked.
So, what I like about this book, so How to American by Jimmy Yang, what I like about it is that it shows anything is possible. You kind of graduate with this economics degree. You go from strip club DJ to Uber driver to stand-up comedy, starring in, you know, one of the best shows on television right now, to movies, to writing this book. And still, everything is open in front of you. And you kind of take, it's like you said before, you're able to take skills and combine them to build new skills. And I think that's a very valuable lesson for people to learn. They don't have to stick to just learning one skill and improving that all their lives. You could be unique by combining all these skills to create your own set of unique, you know, Jimmy Yang skills.
Right.
And I think it's an inspirational story. I think people should get this book and give us some insight. What's going to happen on the next season of Silicon Valley?
Oh, I think it's going to be really exciting. At first, I was kind of worried, even just for my own character, that TJ's gone and he's a good friend, you know. But it turned out, I think, to be a blessing in disguise. I can maybe talk about my part. I don't want to, you know, step on anybody else's toes. But for my part, like, I get to end up interacting with more different characters. So kind of expand my character's world a little bit. And I take over a little bit of Ehrlich's role of being like the asshole, more of that. So it's really fun. I think you guys are going to be excited to watch it. And there's a lot of current stuff that's happening in the tech world, in the world, that, you know, we also address.
That's good. And then, well, look, How to American, Jimmy Yang.
Get on Amazon or anywhere. It's today. Today's the day. Is this podcast come out today?
Steve, when's this podcast going to come out? Can we get it out in a few days? Yes, we want this book to be a consistent bestseller, not just the first week.
Exactly, hopefully. Yeah, so yeah, by the time this podcast is out, you guys can order it, and it's hopefully I'll be a bestseller by then. Who knows?
Well, excellent. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Jimmy. This is really great. I'm a huge fan of the show, your character on the show, and now this book.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. And, you know, it's funny. TJ Miller once stopped by here and was on the stage, mm-hmm. and he was wearing a cast. This mm-hmm. was like a, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe 7 months ago. And he just tells this story. He just came on the fly because he was on a podcast upstairs.
Uh-huh.
Came on the fly and he just told this story of being in the doctor's office with getting this cast. And he was just so funny, just simply relaying that story. And it was all timing combined with just the slightest bit of punching up the story.
Yeah.
And so you can see how different characters form in a stand-up persona.
Ah, yeah. I mean, he's a genius. He's just naturally funny. He's able to make things funny. And I think when you get to the point, I think Louis C.K. said that, he's like, I can make anything funny. Like, I'm a good stand-up. So I think when you get to that point, it's amazing. But also, you got to find what you really actually want to talk about.
Yeah. What do you think you want to talk about? I mean, you've always been talking about it. But
I guess the stuff in the book and just things that are relatable. I don't know what I want to talk about in stand-up yet. That's why I'm still just kind of dabbling a little bit. But I got a tour coming up, so we'll see.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.